Welcome to episode 25 of the Northern Counties Paranormal Podcast, hosted by Within the Boggart Wood. To be honest, there's not a lot of news this week, so let's just crack on straight away. Today's first story takes us across to look at Levens Hall in Cumbria. Levens Hall lies about 5 miles south of Kendal in Cumbria, and is a Grade 1 listed building, park and garden. The hall, said to be the largest Elizabethan house in the county, is owned by the Baggett family, but is open to the public for visitors to look around the hall and gardens. I'll put a link to their website in the episode description in case anyone is interested. The hall seems to have begun its life as a late 13th century peel tower, set south of the River Kent, and constructed by the de Redmonds sometime between AD 1250 and 1300. The estate was sold to the Bellinghams in 1562. And in 1580, James Bellingham refurbished and altered the building. The estate was sold to the Grahams in 1688, and soon after he acquired the place, Colonel James Graham commissioned Guillaume Beaumont, who was gardener to King James II, to design the gardens. He laid out the gardens between 1689 and 1712, with the overall layout of the gardens and deer park remaining much the same today as his original vision. A number of alterations to the house were also undertaken during that time, with work being undertaken between 1691 and 1692, then later in 1709, 1786 and 1796. The main entrance we see today was constructed in the mid-19th century, and the Grahams remained at Levens until the estate passed first to the Howards through marriage, and subsequently to the Baggetts in 1883, when Captain Jocelyn Fitzroy Baggett was passed the estate by his aunt, twice removed, Mary Howard. Now, the folklore surrounding Levens Hall varies between a gypsy curse and ghosts. The gypsy curse seems to have an interesting history, for want of a better word. The legend goes that a young, pregnant gypsy woman came to the hall for refuge one stormy night in the early to mid-18th century, but was turned away by the Baggetts and died in the grounds. As she died, she cast a curse on the Baggetts that no elder son would inherit the estate until a pure white fawn was born in the deer park and the River Kent ceased to flow. In 1896, the River Kent froze over, and allegedly an albino fawn was born the same year, so in theory the gypsy curse over the family was broken. Now, for you observant individuals that are thinking, hold on a minute though, while the legend says that the gypsy visited the Baggetts in the mid-18th century at the hall, the Baggetts didn't actually inherit the hall and grounds until around 130 years later, and only took up residence in the hall in 1885, so the year before the River Kent froze, meaning one of the shortest curses in folklore history. Of course, if you really want to be picky, you then have to look to see if there are any actual records of the Kent freezing in 1896. So far, I found references to it freezing in 1890, 91, 93, 95, and 99, but not 1896. But of course, I may be missing something. Interestingly, this gypsy story appears to have originated in the late 1960s. However, this popular Hammer horror-styly story actually appears to be based on an older tale of superstition at Levens. The earliest reference I can find to the original superstition is 1898, when it was said that whenever a white fawn was born into the herd in the deer park, it was a portent of change for Levens Hall. Apparently, one was born on the day after the Baggetts married in 1885, and another after their son was born in 1896. The superstition does appear older, though, as an account of a white buck being shot at the estate between 1850 and 1860 was said to have brought horrendously bad luck to the household. So where does this leave us with the ghosts of Levens Hall? The hall is said to be haunted by both a grey and a pink lady. The grey lady is said to haunt the gardens and the driveway up to the hall, and is said to be in the habit of walking straight in front of cars and bikes, though the shock drivers note she simply vanishes rather than the vehicles impacting on anything solid. The first reference I can find to the Grey Lady is in an article in the Windsor Star in 1962. The first mention I could find of the Pink Lady was an article written in the press in late December 1969, and appears to have done its rounds across England's newspapers at the time in the tradition of telling ghost tales at Christmas. In it, referencing Hal Baggett, the article states, "His mother says that on his christening day in 1946, she was amazed to see a woman in a pink dress and mob cap peering into his cot. This was the Pink Lady. I have often seen her, and so have others. It is always in daylight, and she is standing or walking in the hall or on the stairs. She is dressed as an 18th century maid. Her pink skirt is looped at the waist, perhaps over panniers, but her cap always covers her face. She seems so real and solid that when I first saw her, I thought, who on earth is dressed up in such old clothes? But then she suddenly vanishes like a figure on a television screen. There's no feeling of strangeness when I see her. She's just there one moment and then she's gone. As well as the two ladies, Levens is also allegedly haunted by a spirited small black dog, often seen bounding through the hall and gardens. As well as this, the hall is said to suffer from the occasional time slip, with an incident in the early 1960s recording that a group of guests witnessed Robin Baggett playing his harpsichord in the hall, only to find that he wasn't actually there at all, but instead on a business trip to Keswick. On an end note with the story, and again one showing how folktales change, I noted earlier that the 19th century superstition had been hammer-horrored in the 1960s into a tale of gypsy curses and dodgy history. By the 1970s it had changed again. In an article from the Liverpool Echo in October 1976, the curse was said to have come about by the Lord of Levens Hall marrying a girl he'd met in the park grounds. They had a gypsy wedding and soon she was pregnant with his child. Once the child was born, however, the Lord of Levens Hall deserted her and refused to acknowledge their marriage, and instead married someone else in a church. One day the mother and daughter came to the hall but were turned away, and as they left, the mother hexed the household with the curse we heard about earlier. Upon her death, though, the mother was said to return to haunt the hall and its grounds dressed in grey, thus neatly tying different strands of folklore together under the umbrella of one tale. Today's from the archives comes from the Weems Gazette on Thursday 2nd of April 1903 and is entitled A Night with Mystery. 30 years ago, a widow named Haynes, living in a village about 40 miles out of London, disappeared one afternoon and could not be traced. She owned and was living in a large house, built 100 years before she bought it, and only a portion of which was habitable. She kept a man and a maidservant, and upon her disappearance, the couple were arrested and put on trial charged with murder, but they cleared themselves and the mystery remained unsolved. Here was a woman known by sight, at least to 4/5 of the townspeople. She lived on the best street. It did not seem that she could have walked a score of yards without meeting a friend. She was in her sitting room at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. An hour later, she was missing. She had not dressed for the street, had not left the room so far as the maid could say. Scotland Yard men worked at the mystery for 6 months before they gave up in despair. 6 months after the widow's disappearance, the house was to let, although stories were already current that it was haunted. The place was first taken by a grocer, who was known to everyone as a hard-headed man with plenty of nerve, and yet after 6 weeks' residence in the house he moved out. He had leased it for a year. I do not know what he may have told others, but he informed me, under the promise of secrecy, that he believed the house to be haunted. It was no use to ridicule the statement, for he was serious and earnest. The fact of his moving out proved that. He, however, made such reasonable excuses to others that he finally subleased to a mason named Applegate. The latter lived there only 3 weeks. Neither he nor his wife would offer an excuse beyond that the place was rather lonesome, but a daughter, 20 years old, said that they heard footfalls passing through the house until all were half scared to death. On several occasions, she said, the kitchen door had been found open when everyone was positive it had been locked. It was a year before anyone else took the house. It was then vacated for good. Everybody now firmly believed in the stories of a ghost, and though it was offered rent-free to poor people, no one would move into it. When it was put up at auction, there was no bid, and so no sale was effected. While ready to admit that I half believed in the curse, I can truthfully declare that the stories reaching me from the time to time regarding the house excited my contempt. For several months before my opportunity came, I was anxious to pass a night there and see what would occur. House and grounds had long been abandoned to the tramps, but yet on certain occasions these tramps made queer statements about what happened there. The windows had broken, the doors torn away, and once fine old mansion was a bad wreck when I inspected it one afternoon. The only doors left intact were the sliding doors separating the parlours. The others had been used for fuel in the fireplaces. I told no one of my intention, but at 10 o'clock that night, armed with a revolver, candle and matches, I returned to the house and sat down on the floor in the corner of the back parlour. There was a doorway between this room and the dining room, and one between that and the kitchen. It was a warm night in summer, with never a breath of wind. It was as quiet as a graveyard in the house and about the grounds. You must not think me boastful when I tell you that I was not even shaky. I was somewhat excited, but not at all nervous. In the first place, I believed that all the stories had been grossly exaggerated, and in the next, I was of the opinion that some practical joker had a hand in the business, if there was anything in it. From 10 till 1 o'clock nothing happened, nothing except my going to sleep. I heard the town clock strike 12, and I heard the first quarter chime. I didn't feel sleepy, and yet I dropped off, and about a minute after I awoke, the clock struck 1. The sound of footsteps awoke me. Someone came up the gravelled walk from the gate, passed around to the kitchen door and entered. It was a shuffling, dragging step. It passed across the kitchen, passed across the dining room, and I firmly expected to see a person in the doorway. It was not so dark but that I could have made out even a rat. No one appeared. I crept on hands and knees to the doorway. No one could be seen. While I crouched there, the step went away from me across the room and into the kitchen to the back door. I stood in the doorway while the footsteps passed down the gravelled walk and were lost at the gate. Whose footsteps, you tell. I returned to the parlour and sat down. In about 10 minutes, someone slowly descended the front stairs. There were no front doors. I tiptoed into the front parlour and thence into the hall. Nothing was to be seen. After a minute, the footfalls echoed down the hall leading into the dining room. I followed after. I seemed to be almost over them. Had there been a person, I should have bumped against them. Down the hall, through the dining room, across the kitchen and down the gravelled walk to the gate sounded the footfalls. Thus I followed them and saw nothing except the gloom of the night. People are told of hearing women weep, of sighs and groans and curses, and sudden draughts of cold air and the sounds of blows. I heard nothing except the footfalls. I went away not because I was afraid, but because I had found out all that I could. In a year or more, part of the roof fell in, and the house became an utter ruin. By and by, a contractor bought it for the material, tore down the walls, and in a secret closet of the sitting room, his workmen found the skeleton of the missing widow. She alone knew of that closet, or she came upon the secret by accident, and while inside it, the door swung to and locked her in, and she was doomed. Today's folktale is the Hazelrigg Dunny, as told by William Henderson in his 1879 volume, Notes on the Folklore of the Northern Counties. I have lately heard from a clerical friend of a strange Northumbrian sprite, who has been entirely passed over in any accounts of the Northern folklore to which I have access. This sprite is called the Dunny. He appears to be of the brownie type, and is located at Hazelrigg in the parish of Chatham in Northumberland. Like others of his race, he is much addicted to mischievous, troublesome tricks, such as the following, in which he frequently indulges. When the midwife is wanted in a farmer's family, and the master goes out to saddle his horse, that he may fetch her, the dunny will take its form. The false creature carries him safely, receives the midwife also on his back behind the farmer, but on their return, in the muddiest part of the road, he will suddenly vanish, leaving the unhappy pair floundering in the mud. Or again, when the ploughman has, as he believes, caught his horse in the field, brought him home and harnessed him, he will, to his dismay, see the harness come slap to the ground, while his steed kicks up his heels and starts across the country like the wind. Some years ago, the dunny was often seen wandering among the crags of the Cheviots, and heard repeating the following verse again and again in a melancholy voice. Cock and hoof, there's gear enough. Collier hoof, there's more, for I've lost the key of the bounders, and I'm ruined for evermore. Hence it is thought that the dunny is really the ghost of a reaver, who had hoarded his ill-gotten pelf in those crags, and therefore haunts them constantly. In Mr. James Hardy's paper on Legends Respecting Huge Stones, the third line runs, I've lost the key of the Bowden door, which corresponds still better with this legend. Mr. Hardy informs me that last spring, when passing a quarry at Hazelrigg, a friend pointed to the steepest part of the rocks and said it was there that Dunny used to hang over his legs when he sat on the crags at night. We'll finish off today's episode with the tale of a charm in Bothell, Cumberland. again sourced from Henderson's 1879 volume. It reads, "About the year 1825 there lived at Bothell in Cumberland a farmer named Billy Briscoe, who had married a widow, and a wealthy one for that part of the country, since her fortune was £60 a year. But unfortunately, she also had a strong will and high temper, and as his were of the same character, the match did not prove a happy one. The ill-assorted couple were always quarrelling. If anything went amiss in the house or the farm, the husband at once threw the blame on his wife, who for her part was never at a loss for an angry retort. Things had gone on for some time in this wretched way, when in despair the husband applied to a wise woman for a charm to protect him from his wife's evil eye, and on receipt of a guinea she gave him two pieces of paper, each about 3 inches square, closely covered with writing, directing that one piece should be sewn inside his waistcoat and the other fastened within the cupboard door. This was done, and the change that ensued was wonderful. All was peace and goodwill. The cat and dog were transformed into a pair of turtle doves. But the harmony was, unhappily, of no long duration. After a few months the waistcoat was thoughtlessly popped into the washtub, and the charm disappeared along with the suds, while about the same time its counterpart was swept off the cupboard door during a grand house cleaning. The spell was broken, peace was over, and the home more miserable than ever. The unhappy wife told all this to my informant, who, as a last resource, asked her why she did not go back to her own friends, since she could not make her husband happy. "I've thought of that," she replied, "but my money's here. And how could I go away and leave other people to eat my meat?" So on that note, thanks for listening to the episode. As per usual, if you want to know more about the project, including social media and Patreon links, please visit the project website at theboggartwood.uk or within theboggartwood.org.uk. Until next time, stay safe and make sure you check your waistcoat before you wash it.